Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Athila Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and I'm joined as ever by Lucy Dallas. Lucy,
Hello.
Last week I, trying to sound cool and casual, asked you what's new, and you replied alarmingly by telling me about a 2,500-year-old olive tree that may have witnessed the Battle of Salamis in 480 AD. Is there, and I ask this cautiously, anything you'd like to bring to my attention this week?
Well, first of all, that makes me sound very unhelpful, doesn't it? When you said, what's
sabotage.
New? And I said, tell you about something really old. And second of all, I think I better say I didn't know about the olive tree until I read A.E. Stallings in the TLS. I wish I had known it, but I didn't know. It's something I learned. Tell you what, how about something new? To answer last week's question, because I watched the new Netflix film Enola Holmes. And Enola, for those of you that don't know, is, of course, Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes's little sister. And it's very jolly, I have
to
say.
Is it good, though? Is it good?
Yes. I thought it was really the central actress. She was in Stranger Things, I think, which I don't know, but I know people love it. Yeah, she's brilliant. And she does quite a lot of fourth wall breaking as she turns around and makes faces at the camera. And Sherlock Holmes is Superman. So it took me a while to think of him as Sherlock Holmes. I haven't actually seen him as Superman, but I think of him more as Superman than Sherlock Holmes. Anyway, it's jolly. And I would really recommend it, actually. I thought it was
Thank
good.
You. That's quite a contrast with last week's suggestion.
It is, yes. It is. And they had a sort of publicity thing with it where they were talking about not fictional. I was thinking about fictional sisters of you know, famous writers.
Shakespeare's sister and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Shakespeare's sister, who did have a sister, but Virginia Woolf conjured up what her life might have been like. And they were highlighting sisters of like Charles Dickens' sister.
Oh, Frances.
Yeah, I didn't know about. Did you know about her?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit, not very much. Certainly not as much as I know about Charles Dickens. Funny
yes,
that.
Quite. But apparently she was the talented one. Apparently, she was all they sent to school. She was all they had hopes for. And also, they were talking about Mozart's sister because she was older than him, and she was originally the one I think who was the prodigy in the beginning. I think in the beginning he would play concerts with her, and then. And after a bit, I'm not sure whether it became clear that he was really good or whether it was just that she was of an age where, you know, you didn't do that anymore.
I mean, I suppose that would be a kind of a precursor to the whole, you know, as actors age, there are fewer roles for the mature woman. So maybe Mozart's sister sort of suffered an earlier case of that.
But very early, because basically you weren't allowed to be a working musician. Really, I think, basically. And the other person I thought of was Dorothy Wordsworth, who is now a better known neglected sister, as it were.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's what I've been thinking about. And I suppose if people knew about other sisters of writers who deserve to be known in their own right, or sisters, you know.
Oh, they could write in.
They could. That's what I'm
leading
up to.
Is that what you're going to say? Okay, yes.
They could tell
Let's
us about
Let's do that. Excellent. Well, yes, write in or tweet or... whatever. There are many, many ways of doing this.
Yeah, people who've been overlooked by their celebrated brothers.
I'm still very interested to know what people are reading. I've had two responses this week that I would like to point to, purely because they give a sense of range, much like Lucy's range. during the build-up to the US presidential elections, Sarah Hoffman tells me that she is taking herself back to the classics and reading Plato's Republic and Dante's Divine Comedy. Meanwhile, David in Finland says that he has been engrossed in Darren Caulfield's Tales from the Colony Room, which we reviewed a while back, in fact, I remember. It's a history of the infamous private members drinking club in Soho, which is probably some people's idea of Inferno, presided over for most of its life by the appositely named Muriel Belcher. David also pointed out, responding to our discussion last week about Agatha Christie's novels as chronicles of their age, that the poet and critic William Empson used to enjoy detective novels not for the whodunit puzzle, but rather to see if, through his famous close reading, he could deduce, from the evidence within the book's pages alone, the exact year of the book's publication. Which sounds a bit like New Criticism's answer to Cluedo. I could be persuaded that there could be a game in this somewhere. I don't really know how you open it out to the floor, though.
Which is more fun, though, doing a very, very close reading to guess a game publication or having a game of Cluedo? It's a close call.
I think horses for courses, Lucy Dallas.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough.
So if you would like to indulge our nosiness and let us know what you're reading and why, please do. Also, if you are in the business of making games, drop us a line, email me or find us on Twitter at @TheTLS or me at @Thea_Linarduzzi. And if you're hovering between books, not yet sure where to land next, perhaps this week's show will point the way. Coming up, the TLS's history editor, David Horspool, will join us to take us through a couple of pieces from this week's issue, including two micro-histories of slavery and emancipation, and the remarkable story of Henrietta Wood. And we'll hear from the poet Fiona Benson, whose collection Vertigo and Ghost, published last year, won the Forward Prize. She will read us a moving new poem, Androgeus. But first, we're joined by our classics editor, Mary Beard, who has reviewed Strange Antics, A History of Seduction, for which the author Clement Knox has valiantly plundered this bewildering, exciting and dangerous grey zone of agency, his words, but emerges with only part of the story. Mary Beard joins us on the line now to fill us in. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Hello. In these days of remote recordings, I do think people like to be able to kind of picture a scene. Can you tell us where you're talking to us from, Mary?
I'm talking from my study at home, which is completely lined with books. But behind me is a late 19th century bust of the poet Sappho. How about that?
Oh, perfect. I feel if the pandemic period ever ends, we can perhaps mark it by issuing some kind of prize for the most unusual or kind of against the odds setup, precariously balanced on some books or whatever.
I'd just like to say that's a very classy setup, Mary.
It lined is.
With books with Sappho behind you. I'm looking at a stormtrooper where I am, so okay. You win.
I've also got a cardboard cutout of the Roman Emperor Caracalla, you know, so it's not all high culture.
I'm sitting here just for the completeness of this. I'm sitting here looking at last week's birthday cards. One of them says "Barking Mad Birthday." So, just a little insight.
Happy birthday for last week, Thea.
Thank you. Right, on to more important things, I think. I suppose the first thing to do with this one is to pick at this slippery term, seduction. How does Clement Knox pin it down?
Well, I think in some ways not entirely satisfactorily. He's got a very big subject. He makes a brave attempt to hit. And actually, he's a real winner. It's his first book. And he's a real winner at telling you a good story, whether it's seduction or not. I think the problem is that the word seduction is going to defeat anybody. Seduction in the eyes of one is, aggressive assault in the eyes of other. And I'm never quite sure how useful a term it is. I mean, I think it's useful to think about its problems. But when you call a book Strange Antics a history of seduction, I think we're bound to end up feeling a bit dissatisfied.
I mean, essentially, it always has to do with, yes, an overcoming, yes, of resistance, and this can involve various degrees of violence. But you point out that in the Latin, it doesn't carry the kind of the default sexual dimension that it does for us now.
No, it's to kind of move off course, really. And I think that, Knox is a sophisticated writer in all kinds of ways, and he is... interested in what makes something a good seduction or a bad seduction, how power is delineated, whether it is seduction for a positive or a negative end or whatever. But I know you'll say that I was bound to think this, but I think that unless you actually go back a bit further than him. I mean, basically, this is a book about the Enlightenment and later. Unless you go back a bit further than him, you don't, I think, start to see the origins of the complexity of the term, really. And he has a passing reference to antiquity and to Ovid. But there you are, back in the first century BC AD, and you've got the Roman poet Ovid writing a handbook of seduction and writing his, in a sense, his quotes, greatest work, The Metamorphoses, which is one story of seduction or rape, if you prefer, after the next. And I think somehow it is in antiquity that you see very clearly all the big issues, actually, about the how problematic the term is.
The Handbook of Seduction, is it the Ars Amatoria?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the thing that I knew very little about it was just reading about it. The thing that struck me straight away as extraordinary is that he has a volume of for men saying how to get women, doesn't he? Yeah. And then a volume, I think, on how to behave, is that right, while you're together?
Yeah.
And then the third volume is for women on how to get men.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that he was that he was treating them equally, but he was looking at the subject at least from both sides.
Yeah, and that's why I think some of the stuff written in Rome is interesting. Now, you know, nobody, you know, you rightly say, Lizzie, nobody's going to say that that somehow Ovid is even-handed here. You know, you don't certainly look to the ancient world for kind of even-handed gender politics. But, I mean, in some ways, one of the reasons that he's so subversive is that he can flip the coin. He can make you see this from the other point of view. What is it, you know, what does a woman do to you? Right? Now, the Ars Amatoria might be, this whole thing is still a bit shrouded in mystery, it might be one of the things that ended Ovid up in exile, right? If that's the case, then I think we do get a sense of the edginess of this. And I think part of the edginess is the idea that sexual agency is not only male, I suppose. And that's a pretty revolutionary and radical thing to say. still is.
But would there have been the same kind of moral framework around it going way back? I mean, I'm thinking, I was just reading this story, a short story by the Latvian writer Nora Ikstena, about Europa, you know, about Europe, Europa, the product in the myth of a seduction or rape. I mean, it seems to me that ancient stories are full of rapes or seductions, if there is a difference there. So I'm wondering, I mean, was there a moral framework there or not?
There isn't a moral framework like we have, and I think that this is talking about rights and wrongs and rules that are not defined by Christianity. And so, in a sense, I think you go to Ovid and you perhaps you look for traces of what we think of as sexual morality, and when you don't find it, because in a sense the Judeo-Christian tradition is still very strong in our own versions of that, you kind of think there isn't any morality there. And I think that would be a mistake, but I think there's a morality really of power and agency. And that comes out, I think, or it has come out very clearly over my lifetime of, you know, on and off studying Ovid. I mean, that's to say, when I was a student, we were taught to speak about what Ovid was describing in a almost bowdlerized way. I mean, we never used the word ravishing in real life, but when it came to Ovid's Metamorphoses, it was one ravishing after the next, which was, in a sense, preventing us seeing this as rape or wondering about the difference between seduction and rape. And I think now what's very interesting about Ovid's work, and the students I teach do get very anxious about reading Ovid's rapes, actually. And, you know, that produces a kind of, oh my God, snowflake sort of response. You know, they can't even read one of the greatest works of literature ever because it's, you know, dot, dot, dot. You know, we can all fill that in. And I can find that annoying, actually, because I think what Ovid is asking you to do is look very hard and face up to some of these issues about rape and seduction. But I think that in some ways I feel quite sympathetic with the students because they have seen these books for sort of what they arguably are. Right now, when you know, our vocabulary of ravishing and seduction. It was partly a way of denying what was going on in these texts. And I think you can't really complain when students see that very clearly. You can't then complain when they sort of object to it. So it's a very good, I think, Ovid's writing in general is a very good bellwether, I think, for some of our own, the complexities of our own moral attitudes.
Well, that book, Ancient History of Seduction or Ovid's Rape, has yet to be written. The book that we do have, to be fair, to Clement Knox, is a modern history. I mean, it probably would have saved us a lot of time if he had put the word modern in the subtitle, but it starts with the publication of Pamela by Samuel Richardson. So in 1740, why start there?
Well, in a sense, it's for him a rare example of a perfect seduction narrative, because the basic plot ends up with the man getting the girl, but the girl having reformed the man, right? So, as it were, it is an apparently happy ending. Most seduction narratives are not win-win. It doesn't take much reading in Western literature to see that. And so Pamela is very, very interesting and very rare, even though at the time, you know, although we think of it now as having been an extraordinarily successful novel, and it was a huge bestseller, you know, there were still people, critics around who were saying, you know, this grubby little girl from below stairs gets the man, you know, so it didn't always appear to be a win-win narrative, but that's certainly how we read it.
One of the stories that you pluck out from his many is the story of Colonel Francis Chartery. I don't know if that's how he would have pronounced it, but it sounds a very interesting one. He was charged with having raped his maid. Is that right?
Yes, I think. I mean, he has many offences that have to be taken into consideration. He's a renowned bounder. He's Charteris, I think we say him, Charteris.
And the public, basically, when he died, the public threw dead cats and dogs into his grave. And the reason I suppose I find this interesting is I wonder if there's some solace to be found here. You know, the fact that the public took against him, there's something heartening about the public choosing to side with a poor maid whose voice was presumably not heard at all versus this wealthy and powerful lech.
Yes, and, you know, a very extreme version of lech. I suspect there was quite a lot of maids whose assaulters would not have found appropriate amongst the observers. But Charteris was a renowned rapist, basically. And, I mean, I think it's a useful corrective for a view that we often have, which is that, you know, back in the old days, nobody minded about that kind of behaviour. I mean, yes, they did sometimes. It wasn't just that people said anything goes for the men, that's fine. But I think there's a kind of sad side to this story in Knox's book, because Charteris's daughter, Janet, remains loyal to this guy. And Knox says something like, and so she does no service to the cause of British women, right? Because she sticks up for her dad. And, you know, I thought, gosh, you know, women get ticked off either way, don't they? You know, either they stick up for their dads and, you know, are now a couple of hundred years later, you know, told off for that, or nobody much minds about what they're suffering. You know, there's a sense that, you know, women are trapped in this story in all kinds of different ways.
I think, is it also, you talk in your piece about he talks about passion and reason. And it reminded me of that old idea of the crime of passion, which is not actually that old. It's only stopped being used, certainly in some places, in the late 20th century, I think. And the idea that, you know, that a man could kill his wife. I know it worked both ways. It worked for a wife could kill her husband who was adulterous as well. But I think the numbers are basically that the man could kill his wife if she was found being adulterous, because he was sort of carried away and he was provoked in some way by it. So you get a lighter sentence. Yeah. Do you think those things are linked?
In all kinds of different ways. But I think, you know, I think that he put a lot of stress on the conflict between reason and passion. But he's pretty shifty about whether he thinks, you know, which he thinks is the good. Is it reason or passion? You know, and just as you think, look, okay, we're brought up with a sense that a crime of passion, for better or worse, tended to let you off the hook in a certain way. You then discover that he thinks that it's rational seduction that's fine. And I found that bit quite... I'm sure his emphasis on rationality and passion as being also something which is really at play in discussions of seduction and assault. But I found it quite hard to pin down quite why he leapt, quite why he approved slightly of one and not the other at different times. And it's confusing, isn't it? You know, and seduction, you know, the reason why it's a good subject as well as a bad subject is it makes you confront that. But it's pretty confusing in the end if you want to try to you know, pin it down. And I suppose I did end up having enjoyed Knox's book, but still thinking, well, so what was he telling me he thought seduction was? Right? And I wasn't sure I had an answer.
It sounds like a productive point from which to start. So presumably more books to follow, please. Certainly more discussion. Briefly, Mary, on a parting note, to change the topic completely now.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, we can't do that. No, we can. And we're going to. We have an essay in this week's paper by Jo Moran. I don't think you've read it yet, but no. The gist of it is he's talking about the university as a place. A place of discussion of precisely the sorts of things that we've been discussing now, and all the things that remote teaching and learning can't provide. I'm just wondering how things are with you at Cambridge, how you're feeling about going into the new academic year now.
I'm feeling deeply conflicted, and I'm lucky because I'm on research leave this term. So I'm standing a bit on the outside looking at my colleagues, and I don't know what I think the right answer is. I mean, up to a few weeks ago, I thought that we have to be as much business as usual as we can. Since I've looked at what's happening in the States and then in other universities whose term started earlier here, I'm becoming less convinced that the business as usual so far as we can approach is going to be workable. You know, and I feel extraordinarily sorry for the students. And I just don't see what their options are. I mean, people say, look, you know, why don't they take a year off? You know, and I'm not sure that, you know, that universities can stand that. And the economic impact on universities is hard to.
Also, quite a lot of subjects where they don't want you to take a year off.
No, they don't want you to take a year off.
In the sciences, particularly, I think it's not encouraged at all.
But suppose you did, what would you do? I mean, you know, it's all very well to think, why don't you have a gap year? What do you do with a gap year in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, Mary Beard, thank you. Thanks very much for talking to us. Thank you especially for accommodating our curveball at the end.
Well, no, that's fine. I have to say, I think that, seduction is probably an easier, difficult concept to get your head around than what to do with universities for the next 30 years. So,
gosh, well, that's saying something. Thank you very much, Mary.
Pleasure. A pleasure.
Still to come, a poem by Fiona Benson and David Horsepool on stories of slavery and revolution. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm told by our producer Ben that by the time this episode comes out, 2020 will have seen its National Poetry Day on October the 1st. To which I give the merry response that pretty much every day is Poetry Day for many of us. And certainly today, no reason is needed beyond the beauty of the poem itself for us to invite Fiona Benson on to read us one of her latest, Androgeus. Fiona, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Without further ado, let's hear your poem, please.
Androgeus. I died in Athens, thinking of my mother. Or was I on my way to Thebes? Difficult to say, this is a slow, forgetting place. There was a competition, I had won something. A crown, a coin, a paper wreath. Then stabbing pain, a bull's two horns, or a bar tab brawl, or an Athenian lover I hadn't treated well, daggering my lower abdomen. Can it have been my father's white bull, the one he bathed and preened? It doesn't matter now. After the wound came dying, fast, then slow, slow, slow. I had doctors and staunchings and stitches and fevers, time to dream about the sun-scorched cliffs of Crete, the sweetness of the singing crickets, the way the thyme would twist and bake, how my lover's skin smelt of it, how, when I took him in my mouth, he'd grip my hair and groan and move me to his pleasure and forget I was the prince. Afterwards, I'd lie with my cheek on his warm chest and watch the fish shoal in the water far below, every stone and crab's claw, every sea urchin's thorn delineated. There came a peace like that at last, when everything seemed clear and calm and bright, and I was sitting on the warm stone step with my mother, eating a dish of cold yogurt laced with honey. And she was singing a soft and faraway song in her other tongue. She laughed and mussed my hair and blew on my nape to cool my neck. And then I died.
That was Fiona Benson reading her poem Androgeus, published in this week's TLS. Fiona, thank you so much for joining us. That was beautiful.
It is a tragedy of the history of slavery that we often get to know the lives of the enslaved through the evidence left by their enslavers. So says Manisha Sinha, a professor of American history in the TLS this week. She writes about the complex picture of slavery, abolition, and capitalism from two points of view, by looking at the life of a slave trader and that of an eventually emancipated slave. And we also explore the life of a heroic figure, sometimes known as Black Spartacus, the revolutionary Toussaint Louverture. With us to talk these through is the TLS's history editor, David Horspool. David, many thanks for joining us.
That's absolutely fine. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us first, please, about this, about what we know about the slave trader William Williams, whose life is detailed in one of the books discussed here?
Yeah, Manisha Sinha's review, two books, one by Jeff Foray, that one's called Williams Gang, a notorious slave trader and his cargo of black convicts. And what it's about is this man, William Williams, who ran a slave trading operation out of the District of Columbia, so kind of Washington, D.C., and he imprisoned slaves and then attempted to sell them across America, even after the domestic slave trade had been made illegal in a kind of compromise ruling in 1850, which attempted to keep slavery alive in America and sort of hold off what eventually became the American Civil War.
Unfortunately, the way he operated, I might be wrong about this, but it seems that it was not exceptional, was it? He was breaking laws and going in and out of jail, but that's what happened.
Yes, I get that impression from Manisha's review that this was a very kind of under the wire world. And she writes about fly by night local and state banks whose currency became valueless once they went under. And it was this kind of world of nods and winks. And for example, William Williams, in the episode that's recounted in the book, he claimed to be taking his gang to the Republic of Texas, a kind of separate jurisdiction, but he attempted to sell his property in Mobile, which is Alabama, and then in New Orleans. So clearly people were kind of conniving at this, breaking these laws, and even when they held Williams to the letter of the law, it didn't really do the people who'd been enslaved or kidnapped quite often any good, because once the case became a disputed one, these poor victims, rather than being freed awaiting the result, would be imprisoned and in fact put to work. So even while their status was being discussed, they were still being treated as slaves.
It's not a part of the story that we hear that much about, the kind of the domestic slave trade. We tend to focus on the transatlantic slave trade.
Well, that, yeah, absolutely. And yet I was thinking about this. I mean, that whole notion of being sold down the river, that is what that means. It's the idea of being a slave in the kind of middle of the country, the upper south, and being sold down to the sort of cotton kingdom in the deep south. And that's how a terrible situation was made even worse for the victims of it, in that their families were broken up. He died, of course, in the course of being sold down the river. And as Manisha Sinha says, its numbers exceeded the number of Africans brought through the Atlantic slave trade to the British North American mainland. So it's an extraordinary part of the story if we forget it, because it's as big and as bad, really, as the Middle Passage and, you know, all the attendant horrors of it.
It seems kind of self-evident that no two countries went through slavery in the exact same way as well. You know, no two legacies are going to be exactly the same. It seems, I mean, the idea of focusing on the domestic trade also will shed more light, more concentratedly on the political and legal structures around slavery that were particular to the US.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, another point that Sinha makes is that it calls into question a kind of slightly more old-fashioned, but it was quite a kind of powerful historiographical current that tried to not exactly justify slaveholders, but portray, sort of humanize the ones in the South who ran plantations, and in whose interests it was for their slaves to be healthy and to be able to work their land and so on. And so there was such a thing as kind of patrician slave owners, which rather discounts, because the idea being that they couldn't kind of buy new ones because the slave trade itself had been abolished. But actually, if it was going on under the wire anyway, and if it was such a massive thing before it was abolished, that again kind of puts another, as usual with the story of slavery, it just adds another horrific part to it.
And on the other side, for the people who were enslaved, what do we learn from the other book? What do we know about the life of Henrietta Wood?
It's just won the Pulitzer Prize. It's kind of another micro history. So it concentrates on this woman, Henrietta Wood, but possibly kind of given away even in the title, Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. One thing you notice there is that the name of the person who is the subject, ostensibly, of this true story, Henrietta Wood, isn't mentioned. And I'm sure that's not a deliberate decision on the part of the author, but it seemed to me almost like a subconscious recognition that these stories are very hard to uncover from the experiences of the person who was at the heart of them themselves. So, for example, as Manisha Sinha unfolds in the Caleb McDaniel book, one of the figures who most dominates the book is Zebulon Ward, a man who tried to buy Henrietta Wood. And she only emerges, actually, when she was able to bring her own case against, because she was illegally enslaved. Although slavery itself was legal, she had been freed. She had been emancipated by her last owner, and she was kidnapped and enslaved in the same way that the subject of 12 Years a Slave, Solomon Northrup, was. So she actually brought a case against her kidnappers to sue for restitution.
And in addition to your point there about the title, about Henrietta Wood not being mentioned there, it's it's true that also Zebulon Ward gives the book its first line, doesn't he? Zebulon Ward of Arkansas liked to say that he was the last American ever to pay for a slave. And it's the like to say that gives you the chills.
Yeah, it does rather sound as if the author's hoping that someone's going to buy the film rights, because that would be a pretty good chilling opening line to any film. And, you know, it's really difficult for historians who are interested in these subjects to uncover untold stories. There are people like Solomon Northup who wrote their own stories, and we have examples of that on this side of the Atlantic as well. But they're pretty well known to students and those who are interested in the stories of slavery. So finding these, you know, considering this was something that affected millions of people, it shouldn't be hard to find new stories to tell. But it's very difficult to really get the source, the evidence, and capture the voices of the people involved when part of, you know, the horror of slavery is to silence the people who are the victims of it.
I suppose what one thing that we do learn about Henrietta Wood is that she was indefatigable, because she hung on and she sued them and she won her case, didn't she? She won some money, but not very much. Is that right?
She won $2,500. She'd sued for $20,000, and Sina says it's a paltry sum for the now very wealthy Ward, who had to pay it. But that money, McDaniel reveals poignantly, went a long way for her son, who acquired property and education in Chicago, and for her grandchildren and descendants. So in the same way that, you know, we talk about slavery as the foundation of American capitalism, this is a tiny example of, you know, the scale, just a kind of straw in the balance in the other direction of someone's whole livelihood and the livelihood of their descendants being based on this, you know, single act of restitution.
And both of the books emphasise this link between centuries-old failure of justice, a failure to compensate slaves, and the modern mass incarceration of black people, don't they? This idea, it's gained more and more traction over the years. It went sort of mainstream, although that's probably overstating it, in 2014 when there was a famous essay by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and then again in 2016 there was another kind of a revival of interest in that idea with Ava DuVernay's documentary 13th, which centred on prisons and the historical racial wealth gap in the US. But is the US nearing an impasse here, do you think? I mean, in which the payment of reparations is, you know, it's been kicked down the road for so long, but is it now, you know, the only way to proceed?
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I think from an outside perspective, and, you know, we'll read Ta-Nehisi Coates or the head of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Smithsonian, great newish museum there. And from the outside, it seems like whatever the kind of ins and outs of financial reparations might be, and how you would decide on the numbers, as it were, seems to be one thing. But the idea of a kind of moral reparation and actually saying there is some restitution to be made to us looks, but it's looked for a long time like a case already made. I mean, you know, Martin Luther King talked about it as a promise. It was a bad check that the government had promised them and then returned to them marked insufficient funds. So we've known about this for a very long time. From the outside looking in, you sort of think, well, they'll kind of come to some arrangement about it, and yet there again, if you look at the American political situation, it doesn't look very much like that's at the top of, I mean, you can understand there are other things at the top of people's agenda, but it's very much at the bottom of one side of the argument's agenda, and actually kind of forces very much denying that are more in the are making louder noises, I would say.
Can we also turn to a great inspiring leader who led his people out of slavery in the Caribbean, fighting off France, Spain and Britain along the way? Because we were also reviewing this week Sudhir Hazare-Singh's book, Black Spartacus, about the life of Toussaint Louverture. David, can you tell us briefly about his achievements?
I could probably tell you very briefly because I know shamefully little about Toussaint Louverture. I want to read this book. He was 18th century Haitian, Saint-Domingue, as it was called then. He had been a slave, was freed, and became a great revolutionary leader and led the Haitian revolution in 1791. And eventually, just after his death, Haiti achieved independence. And he saw off Napoleon's armies. He was claimed later on as a kind of great figure of the Enlightenment and of the kind of revolutionary turn.
Yeah, and he, in terms of Napoleon, he had this, I mean, he was a real French revolutionary, wasn't he? He was a firm believer in Napoleon. The reason the uprising, he was a Jacobin, I think. You know, and the French Revolution said, for about sort of 8 minutes, they said all men and women are equal and all races and creeds and everything. And then they started changing their mind and rowing back on that. But he took that and said, OK, that's what we're going to do. And then fought against Napoleon, who presumably he felt terribly let down by, and then died because the French tricked him, I think, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. No, I mean, hence the Black Spartacus kind of comparison, as we all know what happened to Spartacus, and the same sort of fate awaited Toussaint Louverture. Yeah, that's right. I looked up this thing that he said he'd promised to cease to live before gratitude dies in my heart, before I cease to be faithful to France. And in a way, that's a kind of classic rebel's move from time immemorial, is you don't say I want to overthrow the status quo, you say I want to put it back to how it should be. Rebels against
my France, my idea of France, which, to be fair, Napoleon did join in with, as I say, for about 8 minutes.
Yes, and I suppose you could put Louverture with a whole raft of people who were horrified and disappointed by Napoleon. There are another set of people who welcomed the French Revolution, then were horrified and disappointed by the Terror. But there are, you know, the likes of, Beethoven springs to mind as someone who welcomed Napoleon and then completely was appalled as he drew more and more power to himself. So he fits into that tradition as well, I think.
And Sade's biography, it seems to draw together the many different strands in his life that you mentioned. I saw a French review that said it was a great work of synthesis, bringing it all together.
Yeah, I get that impression, absolutely. I think Alan Forrest calls it balance, it's empathetic. So he also he sees him as all these combined thing. He was a devout Catholic, but he was also versed in African beliefs and Vodou traditions. And then he was also obviously a gifted tactician and military leader, as well as an inspiring rhetorician. So, I mean, you've got all these parts to his life. I'm not sure how much of his private life emerges in any of the studies of him, sort of going all the way back to C.L.R. James and the people he drew on in the 1930s, but he does retain what Hazarin Singh calls his messianic aura. I mean, there is something extraordinary about it's a kind of unique case on the world stage. There were, of course, black uprisings against colonial masters throughout the imperial world, not least in Jamaica, for example, and Barbados, but this was the first occasion on which a single leader brought together a revolution that actually achieved independence for his country.
Haiti was the first independent black state.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, obviously the first independent black state founded in independence from its previous colonial masters. Yeah, I mean, outside Africa is what I mean.
And it is, I mean, it's such an amazing story. You could imagine it made into, let's say, a rap musical. I was just thinking it sounds quite similar. I mean, it's not similar to Hamilton, but, you know, you could easily, it's got just as much,
well, it's much
rich
more,
material, I mean, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably what's so extraordinary about Hamilton is, on the face of it, it doesn't, it's not the subject, the possible subject of a rap musical at all. It, you know, the story of the man who introduced various kind of financial tweaks to post-revolutionary America doesn't sound as if it will make for a perfect rap musical. I think if that idea hadn't been had already, this would be. I think there are various films about Toussaint Louverture, but I haven't seen them, so I couldn't comment.
But I was just wondering whether you think, you know, because it is this amazing story with all these kind of rather spectacular things in it, has his story been a bit overlooked by historians, at least until the 20th century, say C.L.R. James?
Yeah, I think maybe before the 20th century, but it's kind of unsurprisingly, he was taken up as a great hero. So he kind of figures quite highly in those kind of studies. I think maybe more now he is part of a kind of mainstream understanding of 18th, 19th century history in a way that the kind of global historical turn, the kind of idea of looking at history not always from this kind of Eurocentric perspective, even if you're discussing Europeans, you look at how the kind of margins as they would look at it. So I think from that point of view, he's certainly more and more studied and more ripe for study. And the only way in which he might be a sort of cautionary tale is it's sort of almost impossible not to make a hero of him. And that's always a bit of a worry when you're doing history, is you don't want people to emerge as kind of supermen, because it seems unlikely to be a whole truth.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, it says that the review does say that Sudhir calls him the first black superhero, in the sense of presumably that he's the first one that he emerges as this wonderful, powerful figure that can do everything.
Yes, I mean, I suppose if you mean superhero as in kind of Marvel comic superhero, first of two, as far as I can see, which is a kind of another depressing thought, that he wasn't taken up as a kind of popular figure in that sense. You know, black superheroes are pretty few and far between up until, I think, the 21st century, really. So, you know, that in that sense, I think he probably is. You could still describe him as neglected or forgotten, in that he doesn't seem to have inspired a kind of popular take up in the way that you might expect for such an amazing story.
But he is not neglected by us. Thank you very much for talking to us about him, David.
Not at all. My pleasure.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to David Horsepool, Fiona Benson and Mary Beard. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, brought to you by Wireless Studios and produced by Ben Mitchell. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to us wherever you get your podcasts and or subscribing to the TLS itself. And do come back next week for more of the same, although it'll only be the same in a Heraclitean sense, of course. Until next time, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.